on for an extremely successful year and resulted in the ultimate acquisition by Miramax. We're also extremely appreciative to Kevin and Scott for all the work they've done throughout the year. They've joined the IFP on a number of other panels and seminars. So this this panel will be moderated by Peter Broderick. He'll do some introductions for the rest of the panelists. And again, thanks for coming. If I could just ask that at the end of this panel, you make your way as quickly as possible to the exit, and the panelists will be available later on to speak with you. Thanks a lot.
Good afternoon. I'm Peter Broderick, and I'm going to just introduce the various players as we go along in this narrative. 1 year ago, Clerks was at this market without friends in high places, without a grand promotional plan, and without any audible buzz. A year later, it's back at the market, as Rachel said, as the closing night film, before its national release by Miramax and worldwide distribution. So I think this is a very fitting place to have this panel, because it's where the market is really where Clerks was discovered. And is it the last major screening before you go out into the commercial world? So this is sort of a send-off in a way. The charmed history of Clerks is remarkable in itself, and it also provides insights into the burgeoning world of no-budget feature production. As the average Hollywood feature budget has climbed past $25 million, a growing number of intrepid independents have begun making features for under $100,000. It started in '92 with three directors who all made features for under $40,000, Robert Rodriguez, Greg Araki, and Nick Gomez. And those films got major festival play, great critical response, and national distribution. Filmmaker ran a series of articles on these films, and we printed the budgets. And that sort of added fuel to whatever fire was already out there. And by the time of the Sundance Film Festival last January, of the 16 features in dramatic competition, 9 of them were made for extremely low budgets, which was unprecedented in the history of Sundance, and I think unprecedented in the history of American independence. There have been, you know, every year or two, there's been a very low-budget feature, and the directors have risen to prominence, and, the ranging from Spike Lee to... But in this case, it was three filmmakers doing it pretty much at the same time that really sparked this movement. So I think of this realm as off Hollywood, and I think that it's right now the most dynamic sector of independent production. And Clerks is a particularly good illustration of how things are made on this frontier. With us today, we have Mark Tusk from Miramax. And I will, everybody will, talk more specifically about the kind of moment that they, key role that they played in this. Scott Mosier, who was producer, Kevin Smith, who was writer-director, John Pearson, who was kind of a key player as a producer's rep and general supporter and advisor, Bob Hawke, who was on the advisory panel to Sundance, who was an absolutely key moment in time in this story, and John Sloss, who helped Kevin and Scott as their attorney behind the scenes at various moments. So we're going to start by going back to Vancouver Film School, where Scott and Kevin first met. And I just wanted Scott and Kevin to tell the audience your respective impressions of each other when you first encountered each other at film school.
Go ahead.
The first time I met Scott, I was like, wow, this guy's a prostitute? That's fucked up. But, no, Scott was, there was an orientation kind of day at the Vancouver Film School, quite like the orientation that you guys had here and we had last year as well. And Scott came in, and he had, like, the sideburns down here, like Luke Perry and this leather jacket, and he was doing this James Dean kind of 90210 thing. And he seemed very arrogant, and he was from the... He was from the California end of filmmaking. So we just didn't get along.
And Scott, what was your perspective?
Well, here he was in this same trench coat and a pair of shorts, and he's spouting off about all this East Coast bullshit, and I was like, everyone is gonna kill me now. And I was just like, and I just thought, this is the biggest arrogant, the most arrogant bastard I've ever seen in my entire life. And that was about it.
And then about 2 days later, you were fast friends?
Yeah. Because he propositioned me, and, you know, I was cheap.
I like guys, what can I say? No, we actually found out we had this mutual interest in Film Threat magazine. We were the only two people in the class that actually knew about it. And we were the only two people in the class that didn't want to be a production assistant after film school.
So when did you decide, Kevin, that you'd had enough of film school and you had better things to do with your time and money?
The fourth month. Fourth month in. The whole film program is actually 8 months. It's probably, if you read The Village Voice, you're familiar with the ad. It's a strip of film, and there's a little crew on it. And there's a 1-800 number, which is why I called it, because it was free. And it promised, like, no theory and all technical, and it turned out to be, like, a lot of theory and very little technical. So the four-month mark was the halfway point, and I just didn't want to stay anymore. It didn't make sense because it was another $5,000 in tuition and just living expenses in Canada. You have no idea how much Reese's Pieces cost in Canada. And for a guy like me, that's really important. So I had to get out of there, and I just decided putting that money into a feature rather than making, like, a 10-minute film, which is what we would have done, just seemed wiser. For a couple grand more, we would have had a feature. It was a lot of grand more, actually.
So, Scott, did you stay behind when Kevin left?
Yeah, I did, because if I quit school, I would have had to go to work. So I decided to stay, and we made some really bad short films. But at least I met our cinematographer, who's standing over here, who came on to Clerks later on.
Okay. So, Kevin, you went back to New Jersey, and then what happened?
Then I went back to work at the convenience store. When I'd left, I kind of left there. I was like, I'm never coming back. And the first day back, I was like, can I have my job back? And it was basically because I knew I wanted to use the store as a focus for the film.
So how long did it take you to write the script?
About a month.
And then did you send it to Scott?
I sent Scott the second draft, actually. First draft was like 168 pages. It was an epic about a convenience store. It didn't make sense. So I trimmed it down and sent him the trimmed down version, which was, I think, 140-something pages.
142.
Yeah, 142 pages.
And Scott, what was your reaction when you saw this?
Oh, it was, I hated it, but I thought, you know, it's not, we could make some money off it. No, I really laughed. No, I laughed really hard. I laughed more reading the script than I ever have watching the film, because it was just so fresh and so funny. What's Bob laughing about down there?
So then, just give us a little background on,
What? It's more fresh and funny? It's what, the film is stale and stupid?
Yes. No.
Okay, so how did you get the money together, Kevin and Scott, to actually finance it?
Credit cards.
And you had a little left over from film school?
I had the money left over from film school, which I was like, yeah, I'm going to use this for the film, but then I wound up living off that.
And you sold some of your comic book collection?
Did that too, but I sold it in a way. Nobody really wanted to buy it for the amount that I wanted to sell it for. So the comic book store in town gave me like $4,000 in credit for the books. So I would take the books and sell them off piecemeal. Like my friend was still buying comics, so he'd buy like $100 worth of books off my credit and give me $80. So the money was trickling in, just like covering the minimum payments. Mm.
And how did you arrive at the budget for the movie to begin with?
Kevin actually sent me out that filmmaker article with the budget breakdowns for like Laws of Gravity and stuff. And we also used the Slacker budget. And we knew that we wanted to make a film for about $25,000 because that was our credit limit. But I mean, we never really budgeted it out, like how much each part would cost. We just kind of went along and paid the money out.
Mm-hmm. I think the idea was like if we'd known going in how much it was going to cost, it would have seemed like, wow, we can never make that amount. Even if we have the credit cards, it seems such a daunting figure. So we just decided to do it piecemeal, and we figured if we hit 25, we'd start worrying. So when we hit 25, we did start worrying. And $2,000 later, we were done. So, mm-hmm.
So some nuts and bolts facts. Where did you get your film discount? Or how did you get it?
We got a discount on stock at Kodak. Kodak, I'm sure people are familiar with. They offer a film school discount. If you have a film school ID badge, you can actually go in there and get cheaper film. And so we went in, and we had film school badges from Vancouver, but we didn't think they'd work, so we didn't even bother busting them out. So we order our film, and the guy brings out this big package, and he's like, all right, I just need your credit card. And gave him the credit card. We're like, we're in the clear. He's like, and a student ID. And so I look at Scott, and I'm like, where's your ID?
And I was like, oh, it's in my school bag in Dave's car.
And the guy knew right there, man. We were caught, and the guy was just like, he took the film, put it back on the counter. So it was just such an arrogant move, and we probably would have let it go, but he just seemed so smug doing it, and he was the only thing that stood between us and shooting the movie. So we went down to the New School for Social Research, started leafing through the calendar book. It's like, here's two courses. One was Understanding Your Homosexuality, and the other was Roast Suckling Pig. And they were both one-day courses. So I took Roast Suckling Pig, because I understand my homosexuality already. And signed up for that, and then went and got a student ID, and then quick went right back uptown and got the film. And it was like 15% off. Brought that badge in. The guy was just like looking at it, and he flips it over. He checks it four times, and he gave us the film. He was pretty angry.
Same guy.
Same son of a bitch.
And then tell us a little bit about casting.
Casting we actually did before Scott got out there. We did it in February at this community theater. We had two casting days, and it was we wanted to get theater, like, people that were from the community theater, because they were, you know, we figured they could get it right on the first time. They're used to doing one take, and that's it. So, like, Brian and Marilyn have played Dante and Veronica, we got from there, but like on a few other, who else came from?
The old guy
in the bathroom. There's a few people, but like Randall, we never got from the theater, and the girl who plays Caitlin, we couldn't find either out of the auditions. So we actually, for Caitlin, we went to community college, and I sat in on a class, and she just seemed like the most likely candidate. And then Randall just wound up, he was a friend of mine, Jeff.
And then how did you find a place to do processing?
I called around to all these places, and we went to Duart, and we had a terrible experience. So I called this one place, and I'd never heard of it, and I don't think anyone else has ever heard of it. It's called John Film Lab or Yon Film Lab. And I call up, and I was like, and they're like, "Are you students?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Okay, you get a discount." So we went there, and it's like this little. You go. It's on this third floor. It's like all there is a door with a little drop off, and there's like three Armenians back there, and you don't know what they were doing. It looked like a crack house, and we just like pushed the film in like this, and we thought, "Holy shit, we didn't know it was gonna happen," but it all turned out, and they did a good job.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about production. What was the schedule, both of shooting and of your working at the convenience store at the same time?
Everybody from the production crew, which is like four people, to like the cast, everyone pretty much worked during the day. But like for me and for basically Scott, because Scott was staying with me and David as well, and they had to do whatever I did. I had to open from 6 in the morning till 11 in the morning, work the store. From 11 until 4, we would come into Manhattan, pick up the equipment, the film, do whatever we had to get ready for the day's shooting. And from 4 to 10:30, work again. And then from 10:30 till 6 in the morning, we'd shoot the film. And sometimes we'd wrap early, so we'd catch some sleep there. And then Scott learned to do the register, so some mornings I would wake up at 6 and just be like, I can't go on. And he would go next door and work the store.
Real teamwork. And I understand that by the time you were getting toward the end of production, you were getting a little tired with this 1 hour sleep a night, and there were some crucial scenes that you weren't awake for.
Yeah. I went to sleep on my own film. I don't care. It came out anyway. There was a fight scene in the film, which, I mean, I couldn't really choreograph it. I've never been in a fight in my life. I mean, look at me, for God's sakes. And so I was just like, well, I mean, you know, they fight, right? Just shoot a fight. And I just kind of conked out on the freezer case.
And you had no dailies.
We had weeklies.
We had weeklies. Actually, it was more like bi-weeklies.
And so how many days did you actually shoot?
We shot for 21 days straight.
And then you just kind of finished and simultaneously ran out of energy. And
yeah, we just all sort of collapsed. Well, everybody kind of ran away, and we were stuck there with all this film wondering what to do next.
And what month did you finish?
We finished, we started like the first, April 1st almost, so we ended like at the end of April shooting, and then we started to do the editing. Actually, we brought a steam back, because he still had to work all the time, so we brought the flatbed into the video store next door, because I had to work in there while he was in the store.
And was your target to get it done in time for the market? Was that your sort of schedule?
That was it. I mean, like, I'd seen there was a piece on the market on this like special called Made in New York. And I'd also read about it in the Village Voice. Amy Tabin did a column on it. I don't know if she did it more than once, but the one I saw had Richard Linklater in it. So it was the year Richard came back and did the Slacker panel. Were you on the panel? Yeah, the Slacker panel. So I was familiar with it, and it just seemed like, wow, this is where you go. Somebody buys your film, you live happily ever after. Like, we never even considered festivals. We thought, like, this is it. The IFM will make or break us.
And you had never screened the film publicly before the market?
No. Just like our friends and stuff, the cast and crew. Even the cast, most of the cast hadn't even seen the movie by the time we came to the screening here.
So tell us a little bit about what that screening was like.
Well, we had a Sunday screening. There's someone in the audience who has a Sunday screening that's going to scream after I tell you the story. We thought it was a great time. We're like, wow, it's the end of the week, you know, we can build up all this excitement. And then came Sunday, and there's like nobody. And all the other days, this place is just fucking crazy. And we get there on Sunday, and I don't know, everybody went to church or something because there's nobody anywhere. And there was like 12 people in the audience, and 10 of them were like our friends. And the other one sitting down there, Bob Hawke. And the other was this crazy woman who came out afterward and told Kevin that she has a theory that all the Nazis are reincarnated and live in New Jersey, so.
And she's standing there. I don't know if she's here this year. I hope she is. But she's standing there amidst me and my friend. She's like, do you know anyone like this? And I was like, no, never met him in my life.
And wasn't she also an actress that said...
She gave me a resume after she was done. After her tirade, she was like, well, here's my resume anyway. So I think she's going to star in the next one.
So when the screening was over, you guys felt what?
Like shit.
Yeah. We were just really down. We were like, the IFFM cheated us. And we
went hunting for Rachel and
Catherine.
We
began
really
this large involved revenge plot against Catherine and Rachel, which lasted about like 16 hours.
Well, Bob Hawke, fortunately, was at that screening, and but for Bob's presence, the history that you're learning about today, I think, would be very different. So, Bob, maybe you could tell us about how you got there and what happened.
I am going to, I hope, prove that there is no such thing as a bad screening time, and that buzz does work. And I want to talk about what gets me into a screening, using Clerks as a specific example, and what kept me at the screening and how buzz can work. I am a member of the advisory selection committee at Sundance. That means I'm not paid staff, but I've been functioning that way for 8 years, and I've learned over the years that I do not serve Sundance by going to the latest Hal Hartley or Todd Haynes screening. My job is to ferret out whatever I can that is unknown. But obviously, as you all know, with all the conflicting screenings, I have to make choices all the time. So I would like to talk about how I made the choice to go to Clerks. It's always with me, first and foremost, content. And I usually surmise that in the blurb, in the catalog. And I discourage anyone writing a blurb for the catalog that is mysterious, cutesy, elliptical. This is a business, and please say what your film is about. And I was turned on by the content because I have a love-hate relationship with convenience stores. And I also felt that a convenience store could be a great metaphor for today's society, for our value system, etc. I did not know I would also get to laugh so much. But I was put off by the still because it was a cheesy still. And I thought, oh, God, this looks like Amateurville, you know, but the content always comes first, so I take a chance. But one added factor, handouts can work for you, particularly if they have a sense of humor. And I loved the handouts. I have two examples, very cheap and dirty, done at Kinko's, black and white. The first one said, the five greatest epics of all time: Lawrence of Arabia, Ben-Hur, Dr. Zhivago, The Ten Commandments, Clerks. Not quite an epic, but damned amusing. The other one that I liked is, if you miss the Sunday morning screening of Clerks, you'll really hate yourself. In fact, you'll probably kill yourself. I like that. And it gave me a little hint as to where the makers were coming from. So anyway, I walked into the theater. I'm usually a little bit early, and I sit way up front. So I didn't know what was going on behind me, because sometimes I walk into an empty theater, and at the end of the theater, at the end of the showing, I turn around, there are all these people there. So I didn't know what was going on. When you go to a screening in the market, you're poised. You're not totally settled into your seat for a while. And the first half hour was rather rocky because it dragged a little bit. And I was almost reaching for my bag a couple of times. But the thing that kept me in my seat for that first half hour was just when I was about ready to leave, I laughed. And that's always a pleasure to be able to laugh. But then at about the half hour mark, I began to care about the characters, and I wanted to find out what happened to them. And part of it was the acting. One of the big problems of a lot of low-budget films is that there are non-pro actors, and it's a real art to creating a climate and a tone where non-pros do not act within an inch of their life, but play low-key and are real, and I think this was achieved in this film. So it was very satisfying. By the time I walked out, I was really satisfied, but I didn't know what I was going to do except tell Sundance. Within an hour after that, I ran in to Peter Broderick, and he said, "Hey, Bob, have you seen anything lately that you think I should look at?" And I said, "Oh yeah, I just saw Clerks and I really like it." And he said, "Well, I'll take a look at about 10 minutes of it in the videotape library." A few hours later, I ran into him and he said, "I watched the whole thing." So, and he liked it. And Peter will eventually tell you what he did. But then the next day I had lunch, as I often do after the market, with Larry Kardish and Yuta Jensen at the Museum of Modern Art. And we kind of have a post-mortem. And I told them about Clerks. And then went off to the airport. And I had booked my flight separately from everyone else. But yet, there at the airport, on the same flight, were Jeff Gilmore, Kathy Schulman, and John Cooper from Sundance. So within 24 hours, I was able to talk about it, where it meant something. That's how buzz can work. But I'm just one of hundreds of people here who know each other. We all know each other, so buzz can happen so easily, and does, of course. So I want to end this part with just later in the week, I got a call on my machine from Kevin, said, "Well, Bob, I don't know who you are exactly, but all I want you to know is that we didn't have anybody at our screening, essentially, than the people connected with the films. But by Tuesday, we got a call from Amy Talbin at the Village Voice and from Larry Kardish at the Museum of Modern Art, asking for a tape."
Thank you, Bob. I did run into Bob that afternoon, and he told me about Clerks, and he was very excited about it, and I went off to watch it, and I'd probably seen about 5 hours. I can't even tell you how many films in the videotape library that day, and the idea of watching another one, you know, I thought, well, 10 minutes will do, but they hooked me. I watched the whole thing, and then the next day I saw Amy Talbin, who's a friend, and she was asking about what films at the market were worth seeing, and I told her about Clerks, and I gave her the phone number in the catalog, which led Amy to first call Kevin's mom. And I seem to remember Amy said, when she called and said she was from The Voice and she'd heard this was a good movie, and Kevin's mom said, "You mean somebody likes my son's movie?" So eventually she talked to you, so why don't you talk about that conversation?
First it was Amy Talbot that actually called first. We were living in an apartment in Montclair, and she was like, yeah, is Kevin Smith there? I was like, this is he. She was like, hi, this is Amy Talbot from the Village Voice. And I was like, yeah, right. And she's like, no, really. And I was like, and I thought it was one of our friends, basically, who knew what a shitty screening we had and was just rubbing it in even harder. But she kept going on. And it went on for three or five minutes. It was back and forth of me just denying that it couldn't be her and her insisting that it was. I'm surprised she didn't hang up. But she was like, well, you know, somebody was telling me about your movie. And I was like, who? And she's like, somebody. I'm like, you know, maybe this soul-selling stuff does work, because I just promised my soul to Satan the night before, and here's the Village Voice calling. But she wouldn't say who it was, and then she was just like, go send me the tape, because I'm doing that post-market article. And I was familiar with it, so I told her about it. And that doesn't hurt either, if you're familiar with somebody's work, because then she felt all kind of good about it. And I was just like, all right, yeah, I'll send you the tape. So we send her the tape. And then, by the end of the day, when my mother called afterwards, she goes, who was that? And I was like, it was Amy Talbot from the Village Voice. That's what she says. And she was like, oh, Village Voice. Is that liberal paper? And I was like, it once was. And I said, I described the events to her. And my mother's opinion of this movie has never been really that high. I mean, she watched it, and she was like, when we were done, she watched it, and she was gone. So you spent $27,000 on that piece of trash. And I was like, yes. So my mother's always been very supportive. And so she, you know, it didn't really faze her. And then that night, also, Larry Carter's called from Museum of Modern Art. Mm-hmm. Larry's got this great, Thurston Howell kind of delivery. And he's just like, Kevin, this is Larry Kardash from the Museum of Modern Art. Bob Hawke was telling me about your film. And I was like, holy shit, it's Gilligan's Island all over again. But that was a cool call, too. That was also because of that day.
So then Amy eventually wrote a piece about the market in mm-hmm. which Clerks was featured prominently and the phone call with you. And then, Mark, when did you first hear about it? Was it from Amy's article, or had you already heard about it before that?
In my time lingering around downstairs of the Angelica, at some point I'd seen some of the flyers, and they'd caught my attention. And having grown up in New Jersey, I had noted in the catalog that the film existed, and knew that I was not going to be going to the Sunday morning screening, and never led anyone to believe I would. But I had come across Scott and David Klein, the DP, at one point, and I had no idea, because I had, typical of the buyers, I guess, had been hiding my badge, at one point was speaking to them, and Scott had said, well, it's definitely not a Disney film, and which kind of got my attention, because, of course, Miramax had been bought by the Disney company a couple months before that, and I had no idea if he knew who I was or if it was just part of his line, and I probably feigned some interest at that point, but then did see Amy's piece, and had actually come across another film from her column that we had ended up working with, and chased down, I guess it was Kevin at that point, I don't know who. Again, it was the same thing, the phone number was not right, or it was took a little bit of a battle to get him on the phone, but had been promised the tape. And let's see, I'd looked at about, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes of the tape soon after it arrived. And similar to what Bob had said, I found some parts of the beginning to be a little bit slow, and pretty much ejected the tape and didn't give it much thought until I began speaking to John Pearson.
Okay, well, let's come back. We're going to come back to that. So when I was talking, after I had seen the film and talked to Amy, whatever, I talked to John, and I said, because John hadn't had a chance to see the film at the festival, and I was telling him about Clerks, and he should really take a look at it, and John was busy with his other children films, that is, and he was just really too busy at that point to deal with it, but he kept, you know, hearing more and more about it. And eventually, one evening I was speaking to Kevin, and he hadn't heard from John, And so I said to Kevin, well, just call John at home. I know he's there right now because I just spoke to him. Kevin said, no, I'll wait till Monday. I don't really want to disturb him on Friday night. I said, no, call him right now. So you called him.
Yeah, I called his office, and it was an answering machine, so I just left the message. And we were getting ready to go out to see Nightmare Before Christmas, and right before we left, the phone rings. And it was Pearson, like on a Friday night. And I didn't know who he was, and I had that article on my wall, and he's in it, and I didn't even know. I didn't realize that. And he's also in the Spike Lee book, which I never read up to that chapter. So it was very convenient that I never... It was odd how I didn't know who John Pearson was. And so I'm talking to him, and the whole thing that's going through my mind is like, what is this fucking Hollywood player like Pearson doing home on a Friday night calling my ass? And he's neither Hollywood nor a player. So it actually made sense in retrospect. But we talked for a while, and he said, you know, send me the tape. I sent him the tape.
So, John, tell us your reaction and how the sort of process of you getting involved.
Well, yeah, I gotta backtrack. This story goes forwards and backwards in time. First of all, who cares if this mic works? I shout normally when I'm mad or not mad. I'm always shouting. First of all, one thing I gotta say about this group of people on stage is something that Amy Talbin wrote in the Slacker column that has been referred to twice now from a couple of years before. You got a group of people on the stage who really, as she wrote in the Slacker case study, genuinely like each other, and that's made this whole experience unbelievably pleasant. We all, I think, up here really, really, really like each other, and I hope it showed in like some of the good fate that's befallen this film. Now, I'm the schmuck of this story, and the reason is that I'm the Johnny Come Lately in a way, and the reason is that I'm in very deep conflict for the last few years about my relationship with this IFFM, which has grown and grown and grown and grown in size to the point where I can't recognize the way it used to be. Consequently, my assumption, as my role has grown and the number of films I've been involved with, first-time features, has gotten up to about 24, I've become kind of, hostility is too strong a word, but I've become disinterested in dealing with the scene here. Consequently, I've made a point of trying to stay up on things all year long before the market, so generally when market time rolls around, and I have it with me right here right now. This is the one prop you're going to get today. Especially if you sent me a film, you're in luck, okay? What I use the market for at this point is to return tapes that I've been receiving in the 9 to 12 months before the market. If anybody here who sent one, I'll be happy to give it back to you at the end of this panel or put it in your box. So if you have a mysterious tape, it'll be from me. I did not see this movie here, and one of the other reasons I did not see this movie here is that it showed us a completed feature, and I'm allegedly out of the representation business. I invest in movies to complete them now, and when I've done that, then of course to protect my investment and everybody else's, then I will act as the sales agent or producer's rep on the film as well. That's primarily what I do. The only exception to that rule from the last few years has been Clerks, and the reason is that everybody up here, it seems, was calling me, telling me, you must look at this film. You must look at this film. This film is hilarious. And it took a while for that to get into my thick head, because I wasn't at one of my busiest points, to be perfectly blunt about it. I was dealing with the detritus of the release of Amongst Friends. And I was actually really anxious to look for a new, fresh film, because Go Fish was approaching completion, and it was pretty clear that it was going to go to Sundance. And that was all going to be very exciting, and I thought it would be nice to look into something else. And fortunately, everybody finally got me off on the stick, and Kevin and I talked, and when he sent the tape, it arrived at a point when I was away speaking in Louisville, and my wife Janet, who works very closely and directly with me in all parts of the business, watched it first, and I called her, and she said, if you don't want to be in the representation business anymore, you better not watch this film. It's completely hilarious. I fell down laughing at least a dozen times. I came home on a Sunday night from a long, long weekend trip and immediately, you know, said, well, I guess I better not watch this then, huh? Huh? And I found myself sitting there watching it and having the reaction you've heard, even though the film was then about 15 minutes longer than it is now and had a surprise ending, which we'll talk about later, I found myself just basically doubled over in laughter repeatedly. And so what I did was, once I'd seen it, was call Kevin and say, I'm sorry, I just can't be involved with you on this film, because I was trying to resist. I then watched it about another four times, once each day, and laughed harder every time I saw it. And given the fact that there are not enough comedies in the world at any budget level, Hollywood off Hollywood, or in Peter Broderick's phrase, off Hollywood, the fact that I could laugh more watching Clerks than probably at every other comedy I'd seen from any source all that year really meant a lot to me. And that's what basically magnetized me towards the film.
So, Kevin, what was the conversation, the kind of key conversation that you had with John in terms of the two of you agreeing to kind of work together on the movie?
But before we go further, let's just establish the two things we've learned here at the panel so far. Number one, we all like each other up here. And number two, the first 20 minutes of Clerks apparently sucks really bad. Now, that being said, let's move on. After the initial call with Pearson, which was kind of weird because he was like, wow, I really love the film. It's so funny. But I can't represent it. And I was like, why? And he was like, I just don't know if there's a market for this film, and amongst other reasons.
You won't hear that a lot while you're here, I'm sure, so you can appreciate the comment.
So it was the first time I heard it, though. But I think the phone call came about a week later because up to that point, people have been saying, Pearson's the guy that should be behind this film. Pearson will take you really far. So once Pearson said no, we were like, well, what do we do next? And then Pearson called a week later, and John was going, well, you know, I watched the film again, and I think there's a few ideas that I think we can, like, somehow work into this film. But I don't know. Give me a call. It was a message. So I gave him a call, and then we started talking. And at one conversation, he was allegedly out of the representation game, but he was saying, sooner or later, I'm going to wind up just throwing him with this film. And he did throw him with the film. And the conversation that, I mean, the one key note to, like, making the film more, I don't know, acquirable was that ending. Can you talk about that ending?
Yeah, let's talk about that.
The ending of the film, like, it's a comedy, and it's like it was 105 minutes, and at the ending of the film, we basically killed off the main character. We had him get shot and killed in the store, which is, it's not a real good idea if you're doing a comedy. And but I didn't know that because when I was done writing the script, I was like, wow, it's 164 pages of dick jokes set in a convenience store. I was like, I got to make this more. It doesn't feel like a film. What would make it a film? And I was like, oh yeah, kill somebody. You know, they always shoot people in independent films, so. It just seemed like a logical choice to make, but it was apparently it wasn't very logical.
There have been many discussions of how the pacing of this film first worked in the first 20 minutes. It's a subject of some debate. There's no debate that the ending of this film had to change for it to reach the point it's reached today.
And this is actually the third ending, the one that set the market, right?
Yeah. Because the first ending, it's screened with three different endings. Once it only screened once at the IFFM with him getting shot. Then at Sundance, we trimmed him getting shot, but we left in the ominous POV camera of somebody coming into the store about to shoot him, and then rolled the credits so people were like, what, did he get shot at the end? We were like, no, that's the audience, coming in, and you're the final customer. And they didn't buy that lie. So we had to cut it back even sooner to a point that made sense where the film should have ended. That's where it ends now.
So, John, once you had signed on, what was your kind of idea of a strategy? I'm going to come back to Mark now and talk about getting Miramax interested.
This is where the overlap occurs. I mean, first of all, you know, if you're around this market, you'll hear schizophrenic opinions on the whole issue of whether videotape should or shouldn't circulate. And I'm schizophrenic on that very point myself. Between noon and dinner time, I could change my mind five times. In this case, because Kevin had sent some out, specifically one to Mark Tusk, it made it a little bit easier to decide, well, this film's humor is well conveyed by the tape because, hey, it's out there anyway, so let's just deal with that. And we decided to engage in a campaign that involves circulating the film to the key indie distributors, the moneyed key indie distributors, on tape. We decided that Kevin was going to need to be well represented legally, which is where John Sloss comes in, and we decided that maybe ahead of time, as we anticipated at that point, that the Sundance invitation was imminent if it hadn't actually been forthcoming. It seemed very likely that it was going to Sundance, that rather than waiting until the agents, swarms of agents descended in Sundance, it might be a wise idea to have Kevin represented ahead of time as well. One thing that's very important, and that wound up being Tori Metzger at CAA, who got involved before the holidays as well. Now, the one thing that you really got to keep in mind here is that Kevin and Scott were the best kind of filmmakers for me or anybody to deal with because they were enormously level-headed and didn't have any crazy expectations of what the future might hold for them. Maybe the shock of that Sunday screening here at the Market had helped to make sure that those expectations stayed grounded. But the real fact of the matter is that you can have any number of people who've got a film where things begin to go right that get really, really, really carried away, and they were always looking for a modest deal, and that made it a lot easier for me to get committed to trying to help find that modest deal. He wanted something you're always hearing distributors tell you is more important, namely, get with a good distributor, you know, even if there's not a lot of money involved, or if it's not the biggest deal out there, you might just want to be with the best company. A lot of times that's malarkey, but in this case, Kevin and Scott really had that as a going proposition, and they've been very interested in Miramax from the start.
All right, so what was your strategy in terms of Miramax and other distributors in terms of exposing it to them? And
well, why don't we go back to Mark for a minute?
I want to come back to Mark, but tell me first your strategy before we...
Well, the strategy, as I said, was to circulate initially to do a very hands-on, you know, again, maybe this is one thing that I can bring to a project. I mean, we had key people at the key companies. We knew Tom Bernard, for example, at Sony Classics, who thinks that I'm running him down when I say this, but it's actually meant to be complimentary. We knew for a fact that he lived within a mile of the Quick Stop convenience store where this film was made. So we thought Tom's a great person to approach right at the outset here with the tape. Mark already had it. He seemed like a great person to approach with it because it seemed that maybe the attitude of the film would fit his personality quite well. And then I think that, you know, Bingham Ray at October Films is somebody that I don't live that far from, where I live up in the Hudson Valley, so I actually remember taking a tape over to him one Sunday evening for him to watch. And at Fine Line, it was a little more scattershot, and I told her earlier today I was going to say this, so I have to now. The one person there who showed the greatest responsiveness was Leanne Heilman, who's the youngest person who works at that company, so then a pattern started to emerge that way as well. Who am I leaving out? Goldwyn. Eamon Bowles at Goldwyn loved it. Kathy Schulman had seen the film for Sundance and seemed to have a split opinion, if that's an accurate reflection, Bob. Maybe she didn't like it very much. A little more direct, but hey.
Okay, well, let's go back to Mark. And Mark, tell us about the kind of history within Miramax before Sundance, just, you know, the initial contact with...
And we keep up an active dialogue with the Sundance programmers, just get an idea of what they're looking at. Sometimes we feed them suggestions for movies that we've seen that, you know, we want to support but can't really muster up the enthusiasm to distribute. So it was either in discussions with Jeff Gilmore that, you know, the list was being made clear what was going to be coming out, or around the time that the selections were announced in the trade papers that Clerks reared its head again. And in sort of an ass-covering maneuver, I just figured, oh, I'll drop the tape back in. So I actually had a friend of mine was over, rewound the tape, and found that I was like, you know, like John said, doubled over in laughter for the next almost 2 hours. And was warned by this point that the ending that's on your tape is going to change. The main character will not... you know, will not be killed in the final frames. And my skeptical response to that was, well, you know, we'll see if I make it that far into the tape. But it turns out that I really thought it was a gas, and was alerted by John that the movie was going to be circulated on tape to the other distributors. And at this point, I kind of like kicked things into gear at Miramax, which involved putting my thoughts on paper, making a recommendation to get involved with the movie, and figuring if it comes back around again, I can always pull out my memo and say, well, you know, I told you so. So in circulating the film, the pattern that was emerging that John alluded to was that the all the younger people in the audience office seemed to respond to the film, whereas other executives were, could compliment some of the writing or some of the comic setups or what have you. They just didn't jive to the whole film. And the younger people in the office were making this, began to make this a case to pursue. Like, we, you know, got to get this movie distributed or we'd love to work with this. So, like I'd mentioned at the Meet the Buyer, sometimes there's times where, you know, you look at a movie on tape and you like it and you figure, well, wait and see what the, you know, critics say or how it plays with an audience. So we attempted a screening in the Tribeca Film Center, which was supposed to be like the best of both worlds. We'll have a the print to look at so we can see how it projects, and an audience of friends and people in the office who will, will be able to tap the response, and hopefully we'll have the chairman of the company who makes the final decision, come down one flight